Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by all of the Federalist Society's practice groups, was recorded on Monday, April 15th, during a live teleforum conference called, held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to our special Federalist Society Practice Group teleforum conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the launch of the Federalist Society's Practice Group's Executive Branch Review Project and its review of legal and constitutional limits of executive branch authority. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future, and I'd like to note that this call is open to the press. We all know that for some time, many entities in Washington, including the Federalist Society, have conducted annual Supreme Court review and Supreme Court preview panels each year. But surprisingly, no one has been attempting to take a systematic look at the role of the executive branch, the extent of its actions, and most particularly the legal and constitutional limits of those actions. In the continuing era of divided government, many observers have postulated that there has been an increase in executive branch activity, and that increased level of activity will persist. Indeed, just last week, the Washington Post said that it is important for President Obama to solidify the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals as, and here I'm quoting, he looks for ways to circumvent the Republican-led House and a polarized Senate on a number of policy fronts through executive order and other administrative procedures. The Federalist Society's Executive Branch Review Project will be an objective resource on whether there has in fact been an increase in executive branch activity, and if so, with what consequence. The project will provide a forum for debate about those actions and a debate about whether any major federal activities could fairly be characterized as overreach, and that is, activity that might be seen as an affront to the rule of law, violative of separation of powers principles, or in excess of statutory or constitutional authority. The project will include four mechanisms to explore this content. First, we're going to continue to focus our upcoming teleforum conference calls on these types of activities. Second, today we launch a new blog dedicated to tracking executive branch actions. The blog is now live and can be visited at executivebranchproject.com. Third, we're going to host an annual conference. The first will be held on June 11th here in Washington, D.C., looking at these same activities, executive branch activities, and the legal limits. And then fourth, we'll be launching a new publication devoted to the same content, executive overreach. Please take note of our blog address. It's now live, as I mentioned, and can be visited at executivebranchproject.com. That's executivebranchproject, all one word, .com. Today on our teleforum conference call, we welcome two experts. We're going to hear a brief opening remarks from each, and then we'll take questions from the audience. As always, their more complete bios were given to you and are available to you on the Federalist Society's website, so I'm going to be extremely brief in my introductions. We're going to hear first from David McIntosh. He's a partner at the Mayer Brown Law Firm here in Washington, D.C. He's a former three-term congressman from Indiana. His law practice at Mayer Brown focuses on all manner of government affairs. He served in both the Reagan and first Bush administration, and he did this after becoming one of the co-founders of the Federalist Society. After we hear from David McIntosh, we'll hear from Senator Mike Lee, who was elected in 2010 as Utah's 16th senator. He spent his career thus far defending the basic liberties of Americans and Utahns as a tireless advocate for our founding constitutional principles. Importantly, he was president of the Federalist Society chapter at his law school, BYU. And with that, welcome, David McIntosh, and please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you for coordinating this project for the Federalist Society. I think the issue raises a lot of constitutional questions, including not only the separation of powers you mentioned, but also issues of enumerated powers and what is the proper scope of delegation of policy to the executive branch in the regulatory program. I've been on both sides of that issue, having worked for President Reagan and Vice President Quayle on supporting the regulatory oversight process run by OMB, and then in the House chairing a committee on regulatory relief where we monitored what was going on in the executive branch. And I have to say, at this point, we're seeing an all-time high in executive activity, particularly regulatory activity, driven in part by legislation that was passed in the first term of the Obama administration in healthcare and financial services regulation under Dodd-Frank, but also the president has signaled it's a key priority for him. In fact, if you go to the White House website, there's an entire page titled "We Can't Wait," which is taken from a quote that's given there by the president where he says, "We can't wait for an increasingly dysfunctional Congress to do its job. Where they won't act, I will." And there's no limitation, at least on that website, of what the executive powers that he plans to assert will allow him to act. And there's a long list day by day of things that he has done in the past. One of the things listed has already raised a constitutional issue, and that was the appointment of Richard Cordray to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been challenged directly in a lawsuit and is implicated by another suit where the courts have held that the president's use of his appointments authority during a recess was inappropriate when Congress was not, in fact, in recess. And so there are already things on the website that he's talking about which are going to end up leading to very difficult questions of constitutional law. I'm going to defer to the Senator Lee for a discussion of some of the costs and the impact of the different regulatory activity, but let me outline just a few areas where we see things happening daily that'll have a huge impact on the American public. The health care bill, the Obamacare, they're setting up the exchanges through the states. Many states have tried to resist that, but essentially requiring that there be a new definition of what the essential benefits are that have to be offered by private insurers, and therefore massively regulating the exactly what is in each person's health insurance package. Part of their regulatory approach has already created huge disparity among the states because they grandfathered the older existing limits on what benefits are. The result of that is there's a huge disparity of subsidies that will occur to individuals in some states versus other states, raising a significant equal protection cause, I would think. In the financial services, Dodd-Frank is wrestling with how to implement too big to fail, and as we've seen over the last several decades, a consolidation of the financial services into the five largest banks, as well as regulations on derivatives and other financial services. In the climate area, EPA has been urged by various groups, including the World Resources Institute, to aggressively use its regulatory power under the Clean Air Act, not only to regulate carbon emissions from power plants and methane from oil and gas production, but also fluorocarbons from all sorts of manufacturing and refrigerant uses under a little-known section of Title VI of the Clean Air Act. And they're currently having to consider how much they want to do and what authorities they believe they have at EPA. But on other issues, labor, there's a gridlock at the NLRB. If that's broken, the president signaled to the unions he wants to be aggressive in implementing their agenda, including the card check provisions that Congress declined to pass into law. And the FCC has been called upon by Democratic members of the Senate to not only regulate the internet, but also use their authority to control communications, electronic communications, to regulate the disclosure of political spending by private groups. And so there's a broad array of issues that will come up and have already been put on the agenda under this area. The president's philosophy, as stated in his website, would be a signal to the agencies to be aggressive in interpreting what their scope are. The courts have begun to consider these questions. In fact, there's a Supreme Court case this year on the question of how much deference the courts have to give to the agencies as they define what their jurisdiction is. The outcome of that will play a key role in how effective the Administrative Procedures Act is in providing private citizens the right to challenge the regulatory activity of these agencies. And so this is a commendable project for the Federalist Society. I'm glad to be part of it. and delighted that Senator Lee has joined us with this and his perspective up on Capitol Hill. I'm a huge fan of yours, Senator, as a champion of constitutional conservatism, somebody from Congress who watches the executive branch and says we all have to live under the restraints in the Constitution and do our job that way. So without further ado, let me turn over the microphone to Senator Lee.
Thank you very much, David. It's an honor to be on the call with you. And I'm especially honored to be asked to share some of my thoughts about this important subject. You know, in recent decades, what we've seen is the executive branch has been claiming for itself more and more of the power of government. And this is a trend that has now reached new, really disturbing levels under this administration. President Obama has treated the Constitution's separation of powers as if it were kind of a matter of convenience that may be ignored whenever it gets in his way. So rather than cooperating with Congress, in many instances, he's chosen to just go it alone, as he likes to call it. And in the process, he's exceeded the proper bounds of executive power. For example, with his recess appointments of January 4th, 2012, the D.C. Circuit found that he exceeded his constitutional authority. Then there's his obstruction of legislative oversight when he asserted executive privilege in connection with the Fast and Furious investigation, as well as his refusal to enforce immigration laws for the reasons outlined in the Morton Memorandum. Even after the legislation after which many of the policies in the Morton Memorandum were based had been considered by Congress and failed to achieve the necessary votes in Congress. So this is some of what he's chosen to do, is when he's not able to get his way through the legislative branch, he'll just go it alone, as he points out, as he puts it, which is kind of an awful euphemism. But as James Madison explained in Federalist 51, a properly framed constitution must enable the government to control the governed, and it must also oblige the government to control itself by means of internal checks and balances. To accomplish that internal control, the Constitution gives each branch the necessary means and the personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. Without the effective functioning of these checks and balances, one single branch of government might be able to accumulate all powers, the legislative power, the executive power, and the judicial power. And that result is one that, as Madison put it, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny when you consolidate all those powers into one. I'm really pleased that the Federalist Society is helping to give friends of liberty and the rule of law a critical tool to help us to resist this kind of illegitimate aggregation of power. It is important for us to remember that Article 1, Section 1 gives Congress all legislative powers. This requirement limits the scope and the volume of legislation that can move through the federal government, and it ensures that the policy decisions are made by the people's elected representatives. When an administrative agency, rather than Congress, makes broad legislative rules, or if it enacts regulations or promulgates regulations that overstep or contravene legislative policy as developed by Congress and is put into our statutes, then the executive branch is violating Article 1 of the Constitution. This is something that the executive branch has done with increasing prominence and increasing frequency under President Obama. So this ends up putting a lot of burdens on American society. So, you know, small businessmen tend to rank federal regulations and government red tape generally as the greatest single impediment to growth and success. And it's not a partisan issue. You know, former Senator Blanche Lincoln said small businesses' ability to grow and create two-thirds of the net jobs annually has been threatened by a growing number of burdensome regulatory requirements handed down from Washington. In its first 3 years, the Obama administration has adopted 100, or it did adopt during that first three-year period, 106 new major rules, defined as rules that have an economic impact of $100 million or more nationwide. 106 new major rules in that first 3 years. This compared to 28 new major rules in the first 3 years of the George W. Bush administration. This is an increase of 279%, which is really significant. You can't just chalk that one up to the growth of the U.S. population generally. New rules promulgated during 2012 imposed an additional $56.6 billion in compliance costs. $56.6 billion in compliance costs and more than 114 million hours of paperwork burden. The number of federal regulators under the current administration has increased by more than 34,000, and the administration proposed an additional 7,000 regulators for 2013. This would represent an increase of 17% over 2008. Now, the Dodd-Frank Act mandated over 400 new rules, and it's already led to 8,800 pages of new regulations, even though this is only one-third. This reflects only a one-third implementation. By one estimate, the rules already adopted will cause 52 million hours of paperwork and $7 billion in direct compliance costs. According to CBO, over the next 10 years, Dodd-Frank will take $27 billion directly out of the economy in new fees and new assessments. Then there's Obamacare. As of August of 2011, the administration had already released more than 9,000 pages of Obamacare-related regulations and notices and other mandates in the Federal Register. And in 2010, the average Obamacare regulation received only 5 days of OMB review. This is far less than other regulations. So I've identified, in addition to the constitutional problems with the with today's federal regulatory state, 10 flaws that tend to permeate today's federal regulations beyond those that I've identified already. Number one, there's too little attention to the costs. Number two, there are too many permits. Number three, there are too many delays that they cause. Number four, there's too much wasteful litigation that occurs as a result of them. Number five, they create too much uncertainty. Number six, there's too little supervision and too little accountability associated with them and their implementation and promulgation. Number seven, there is too little public information. Number eight, there's too much overlap in agency jurisdiction. Number nine, there's too much interagency conflict. Number 10, there are too many crimes, and the proliferation of federal crimes has occurred in tandem with the growth of the modern federal administrative regulatory state. Let me put something kind of in closing into perspective and put the Federalist Society's Executive Branch Review Project in context with something that Elena Kagan, now on the Supreme Court, something that she wrote before she got on the court. She wrote that bureaucracy is the ultimate black box of government, the place where exercises of coercive power are most unfathomable and thus most threatening. To a great extent, this always will be so. The bureaucratic form, in its proportions, its reach, and its distance, is impervious to full public understanding, much less control. The Federal Society's Executive Branch Review Project will provide easily accessible information to the public and to the press, to congressional overseers of the breadth of regulatory action undertaken by the administration, whether through presidential, White House, or agency action. As I understand it, this project is going to include a web-based component, a new publication, an annual conference, and programming throughout the year, all of which will highlight and debate instances of perceived overreach by the executive branch. This is sorely needed, and I'm so grateful to the Federalist Society for doing it, and I want to be helpful in any way I can. So thank you for asking me to join you.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. This is Dean Reuter joining in again. Senator, do you have time for a question or two?
Oh, of course, absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's open the floor to questions then. In a moment, we should all hear an announcement that says the floor mode is on, and then you'll need to push star and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question, so stand by. So once again, if you have a question for either Senator Lee or Congressman David McIntosh, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our phone lines are open. Let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, caller. If you have your phone muted, you might need to unmute your telephone. Looks like that caller disconnected himself. So let's go to our next caller. If you want to join the queue to ask a question of Senator Lee or David McIntosh, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, it's Lori Callahan in San Francisco. If there is a challenge to... can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Procedurally, how is an act of Congress going to be challenged, as you've described one of the objections? For example, the Congress is not in session. How does that be raised? Just in court, or what's procedurally going to happen there?
I'm not sure what you're asking, sir. Are you asking about the recess appointments?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, that has been challenged in court. The way it was challenged in court was that a company called Noel Canning brought a challenge to an order issued by the National Labor Relations Board, which was the recipient of three of the four unconstitutional recess appointments made by President Obama in January of 2012. That action was brought and was decided before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. It was decided just a few months ago. My understanding is that following that ruling, the Obama administration will be challenging that before the U.S. Supreme Court, and so we expect a final ruling sometime in the next year or so on that issue. But yeah, that's how it comes up, is that once the president makes those recess appointments, as soon as the body, the administrative body affected by those appointments does something, it issues an order or something, then people have the ability to challenge that in court.
The people with standing to challenge it are the parties to the ruling impacted by the ostensibly improper decision, correct?
Correct. That's right. That's right.
Does the Congress have standing?
Under Raines versus Byrd, a lot of people make the point that members of Congress, just by virtue of their being members of Congress, do not have standing to do that. I personally consider that a grave injustice, but that is the view that a lot of people take.
Thank you.
Let's go to our next caller. If you want to join the queue again, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski in New York. Maybe this is venting frustration, but I actually read a big chunk of the Obamacare bill, H.R. 1300, the prior version of what was passed. And what I've saw in the legislation and in practice is that the administrative agencies essentially have free rein to enact anything that they like by rule. Slight overstatement, but the granting of waivers, the delaying of implementations, we see this in Dodd-Frank being so far behind, it seems almost as if Congress has abdicated its authority to actually enact real legislation that someone can read, understand, and follow, and just say, we want to fix some problem and send it off to the SEC, HHS, IRS to write regulations that will achieve some very broad brush objective. And is there any sense of, if you will, and not to be disrespectful, of self-respect of within Congress of themselves to exercise their authority to write specific legislation that people can actually understand, and you don't need a massive bureaucracy to fill out all of the details?
That's a great question. I'm very glad that you asked that. First of all, there is far too little enthusiasm in Congress right now for Congress to defend its own institutional prerogative as the legislative branch of the federal government. One of the reasons for that is it's far too tempting for members of Congress who are not driven by any kind of consistent ideological grounding. To just focus on what's going to be the least objectionable thing for them to do on any given day, what's going to give them the greatest chance of getting reelected, and what's going to give them the greatest chance of appearing to be wise and supportive of good causes. Let me give you some examples. Let's take a hypothetical extreme example to prove the point. Congress is an institution that would very much like to pass anything that just sounds good. Let's suppose somebody brought forward a law that said, this is a law to make sure that we have good laws. And the law says, we, as the citizens of the United States of America, shall be governed by good laws. And we hereby delegate to the U.S. Department of Good Laws the power to promulgate, administer, and enforce regulations carrying the force of generally applicable law to govern the American people. And it's introduced as the Good Law Act. It's that kind of thing that, you know, obviously this is an extreme example, but I'm using a caricature to illustrate a point. When you outline something in legislative form under a broad aspirational pretense, something that just sounds really good, nobody can disagree with, then all of a sudden, if you vote against the Good Laws Act, then you're somebody who doesn't like good law, and so you must be horrible, and nobody wants to do that, and so they do it, and they part with their legislative authority little by little, ultimately outsourcing to some administrative bureaucracy that is going to be operated by men and women who are, I'm sure, well-educated and I'm sure well-intentioned, but who do not stand accountable to the people in regular increments. And until we as a country and as we as voters start to expect more and start to require more of our members of Congress, that's going to be difficult to do. Now, there is one important thing that we can do about this. There's a legislative proposal called the RAINS Act that's been moving through Congress, R-E-I-N-S. What the RAINS Act says is that whenever we pass a major rule, whenever there is an administrative agency that promulgates a regulation characterized as a major rule, you know, an economic impact of more than $100 million a year, that it will not take the force of law, it will not take effect until after it's been affirmatively acted into law by both houses of Congress and signed into law by the president. That would allow us, in other words, to maintain whatever benefits we can achieve from the expertise we have in our federal agencies, without giving them what is tantamount to wholesale lawmaking authority.
All right, yeah, I guess one sort of sad commentary was a good friend of mine, Nan Hayworth, who you probably have met, got voted out after one term and was one of the types of legislators who would have voted against the good law bill because it, in fact, was bad law. But I guess that's an example of the consequences of actually doing your job the right way.
That's right. That's right. Doing the right thing and following the Constitution doesn't always make you popular, but that's one of the things that we need to try to change by informing people about the consequences of this kind of lawmaking.
All right. Let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name's Dennis Chapman. I'm an Army officer here in Northern Virginia. My question's for Senator Lee. Senator Lee, first of all, I wanted to just a couple of personal comments. I saw you speak at the Federal Society Convention. I thought you were wonderful. And I really wanted to thank you for your work on trying to hold back the tide of gun control legislation moving through the Senate right now. It's regrettable that not every Republican stood with you, so I wanted to acknowledge that. My question is this, taking it back to maybe first principles a little bit. Most federal regulations emanate from an agency that is created by an act of Congress, and they usually are based upon some statutory authority provided by Congress. I would think there are very few regulations that would emanate directly from the president's own inherent constitutional powers. And then for most of these acts that are passed, or many of them, the power source in the Constitution would be the Commerce Clause. And we know that the scope of the Commerce Clause expanded almost unstopped for many, many years after the New Deal, until U.S. v. Lopez, when the Supreme Court finally said, okay, we're not going to expand it anymore. The problem is it doesn't seem like U.S. v. Lopez has had any discernible effect. Congress turned right around and repassed the Gun-Free School Zones Act with some ritualistic language about guns having been in interstate commerce, and it's been unchallenged ever since. So I guess my questions are, one, what are the prospects for reining Congress's use of the Commerce Clause power back within reasonable boundaries? And then a more specific question is, since most gun control legislation that the federal government is going to promulgate is going to be based upon statute and based upon the Commerce Clause, is there any prospect for Commerce Clause legislation to slow down the erosion of our Second Amendment rights? Thank you.
Okay, so on the first point, you're right. Lopez and Morrison have proven to be something of a blip on along the radar screen, suggesting in some ways that as long as Congress utters the magic words when it legislates under the Commerce Clause, it can usually do what it wants. That is not always the case, but you know, as long as Congress doesn't get too sloppy and too reckless, it can usually find a way to shoehorn in whatever it's trying to do under the Commerce Clause. There still are some limits in light of Lopez and Morrison. You know, you can't go too far in regulating activity that is distinctively non-economic and without some kind of jurisdictional interstate hook. The problem with this is that a lot of the whatever limits were still intact a year ago, as a practical matter, may have been vitiated by the Supreme Court's ruling in the NFIB case in which it upheld the Obamacare law. I've actually been working on a short ebook that will be out in the next couple months on this very issue, in that the Supreme Court effectively rewrote the Affordable Care Act, not just once, but twice in order to save it. And in one of those two instances, it rewrote the Affordable Care Act so as to conclude that it can be upheld as a tax, even though according to 100 years or more worth of jurisprudence, it was a penalty and not a tax. And so now what Congress may not do under the Commerce Clause, it might be able to do pursuant to its authority to tax. And here's the kicker that the NFIB case gave us. Even then, it doesn't have to acknowledge that it's imposing a tax. It can claim, as it did when it passed the Affordable Care Act, that it's imposing a penalty, but then it'll be treated as a tax under this very, very dangerous precedent. And so I don't say that to depress everyone. I say that to point out that we have some work to do as far as explaining to the American people what has happened to what was supposed to be a system of government in which on the national level the powers would be few and defined, and at the state and local level the power would be the powers would be numerous and indefinite. Your second question dealt with the Second Amendment ramifications. I'm trying to remember exactly what the question was. Can you repeat that part of it?
I'm afraid he's no longer an open mic. I think he was talking about the extent of the commerce power and how it could be used to limit the Second Amendment.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, most of our gun laws, Section 922 of Title 18 and otherwise, most of our gun laws are enacted pursuant to the Commerce Clause and have language, sort of jurisdictional hook language in them, making clear that they're connected to interstate commerce. But they still use the same kind of language, the in or affecting commerce language that we've had that's been blessed by the court ever since 1937 in NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steele, as expanded by Wicker v. Filburn, and we've had that in place more or less ever since then. So there again, the danger is that very few things, if any, are beyond the power of Congress to regulate on a national basis. The Supreme Court has made clear over and over again that it's not going to do this job for us. So it may be that in order to return to constitutionally limited government, to a kind of national government where the power at the national level really is limited, that we might have to do that through the same kind of process that got us into this in the first place, that is through the political branches.
Well, Senator, this is Dean Reuter again. I understand you have to move on to your next piece of business. I do want to thank you. I think we've kept you even over the agreed upon time. I want to thank you for joining the call. We'll continue on with David McIntosh, but Senator, thank you so much for spending some time with us and especially for taking questions.
Thank you very much, Dean, and thank you, David, and thanks to all of you for joining us. I appreciate the chance to talk to you, and I'll turn it back over to you. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. Thank you, Senator.
We do have a couple questions pending. If you want, I have a question for David McIntosh, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the next question, let me make our typical programming announcement. We've got four Teleforum conference calls scheduled for the remainder of the week. Tomorrow at 12 noon, we'll be talking about a proposed internet sales tax, something that's probably of concern to a lot of people on this call. That's tomorrow at noon. Wednesday at 2 p.m., we'll have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum when our expert, who will be attending oral argument in this week's case, the Myriad case concerning DNA and patents. That is Wednesday at 2 p.m. And then Thursday at noon, we'll be giving you an HHS mandate litigation update. And then Friday, also at noon, we'll be talking about copyright enforcement with our panel of experts. So today, again, we're talking about executive overreach. Now with former Congressman David McIntosh, let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Mike Doherty calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And obviously this problem is certainly quite large and overreaching in and of itself. So I probably look at a big picture on how to actually get control of it. And my thoughts, first of all, in the short run, is to neutralize by winning the Senate back in 2014. I'm real concerned about two big things. And one is the judicial branch moving so slowly and really being hesitant to step in and put their foot down, and educating the people so they really comprehend what's going on. Because as we talk about the good laws that sound good, so much of this is public positioning and they don't pay attention. And I think the Obama administration is quite aware of that. And I just wanted to know what your comments were on those two areas of concern.
Yeah, and Let me focus on the role of the different branches rather than a political question. But
okay.
there are two main checks that I see as critical to restraining the executive branch in this area. One of them, the traditional one, has been the congressional check through oversight of how the agencies are implementing the statutes that have been passed. And significantly through the appropriations process, where they either directly say no funds shall be spent to go in a direction that Congress doesn't approve of, or indirectly, you know, use the power of the purse to communicate to the executive branch agency, you're taking a step too far, we didn't intend you to have that authority, you don't really have that authority under the statute as we understand it. Those have been effective tools that Congresses in the modern era have used. And frankly, this Congress and the President's statement of label of dysfunctional is accurate in this sense. This Congress has been unwilling and unable to assert the power of the purse or effectively even oversight over the executive agencies. Why is a good question. You can theorize that perhaps it's the political impasse between the House and the Senate, although in the past that the jurisdictional claims and the preservation of authority that each branch has typically been a higher imperative for members of Congress than partisan members. So it was surprising to me to see senators, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, agreeing to allow a president to assert appointment power in a case that was unprecedented when the Senate maintained that it was remained in session. But nonetheless, we saw a failure of the Senate to act in any meaningful way to try to put a check on that assertion of executive branch power. That then leaves the courts and the challenges that we're seeing there, where, as the senator pointed out, you've got to have somebody with standing who's affected by the actions of the agencies that are allegedly beyond their authority. And then the courts have to review it and decide, is there a problem of separation of powers here? There's a natural reluctance in the courts to intervene in a political question, but they have been and should be willing to draw the lines on separation of power when one branch asserts more power than it has and it affects private citizens. They're going to be reluctant to support congressional power where Congress itself doesn't assert that and take actions that it has under its constitutional authority to protect it, but they will and recognize their consequences to private citizens when the executive branch acts beyond its constitutional authorities. But nonetheless, they're cautious in that area, and correctly so. And then the other area where the courts have been involved traditionally has been in the review of regulations under the Administrative Procedures Act. And this, they've give great deference under the Chevron doctrine to the agency's policymaking preferences, as long as they are not arbitrary and capricious. And that frequently raises a question of jurisdiction. Are they exceeding their jurisdiction in the particular rulemaking? The courts are now wrestling with, well, the agency says they have jurisdiction, the private plaintiff says they don't. Do we have to defer to the agency, or is that a question that we, the third branch and the judicial branch, should determine on our own? We'll see how the Supreme Court comes out on that particular call. To me, it seems pretty obvious the incentives to overstate jurisdiction to protect a decision that the agency's reached mean that you need some sort of check by the judicial branch of an independent review. But whether the courts reach that decision or not, we won't know until the Supreme Court hands down its decision. But those are significant checks that the judicial branch has and should use, and have become more important in practical terms with the shrinking nature of the congressional assertion of its own authority caused by the dysfunction, as the president labels it, of the first Article I branch in Congress.
We're speaking with David McIntosh. If you have a question for former Congressman McIntosh, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two more questions in the queue, then our lines will be open.
Thank you. This is Bob Davis in Maine. I applaud and thank you folks and the Federalist Society for trying to shine the light on what I think is a tremendous problem. I think it's wish it had been started decades ago, actually, because the trend has been there. It seems to me that the institutions for a free society are well established and were established by the Constitution for the most part. The problem is that the culture no longer wants liberty. Hayek quotes someone to the effect that true friends of liberty have always been rare. And I think that's true. It would seem that, has the culture changed so much that there's not the desire of liberty for the desire of liberty, no matter how successful you are in shining the light on it. And it comes down to this, which I don't, maybe a question that you don't want to answer directly, but does it take a revolution by the minority to achieve the blessings of liberty for all? In other words, within the law schools, within the education community, within the media, all of those institutions outside of government really need to be changed in order for people to appreciate and want a truly free society, as opposed to a welfare state where they're taken care of by a government. So how do you propose to get people to vote for people who will pursue the goals that are desirable in achieving and maintaining a free society?
Well, one of the things that I guess that I've always believed in is that the battle for ideas and Hayekian view of liberty and the benefits that brings to not only to individuals but society as a whole can't be taken as a given in the political discourse, but has to be continually defended and asserted and explained. to current generations and future generations of citizens. And so I think your point's really well taken that in order to our system of government ultimately with lots of checks and balances and breaks that on the system to make change occur slowly, ultimately is a democratic impetus in its core. And therefore, if we want Washington and whether it's members of Congress or the president to govern in a way where they value liberty, we have to have that be a value that, as you pointed out, has the American people seem no longer to care as deeply about. My thought on this is they will care about it when their attention is brought to it. And so the institutions outside of government, institutions like the Federalist Society and the law and other institutions in other sectors, need to continually bring back the debate about liberty, and ultimately we need to continue to frame that debate in terms of the not only the economic but also the moral values that support it and the virtues that occur when you have a free and open society, and the as the framers labeled it, essentially the right to pursue happiness that individuals have and are to be guaranteed under our system of government. And then, but as the framers in the Declaration pointed out, our inherent rights, regardless of what form of government we're under, those notions oftentimes are not discussed today, and including in modern language of people should have the right to pursue their dreams, the American dream, and our system of government has frequently, in the name of security or social justice or other values, denies people the ability to pursue those dreams. And it's our job to kind of bring back the debate in the public square about the consequences of that government action, and both intended and unintended, and remind people of why it's important to engage in the process.
Conservative groups are doing this, and I think doing a fine job of it. But to a large extent, they're preaching to the choir, people they really don't need to convince.
Right.
What is needed, and I don't really see it coming, is for the Republican Party to see itself as primarily an educational institution, because they at least have a microphone, if we could get the leadership that we needed there, to reach people and have them at least think about it. Now, people like Tolman's Origin of Totalitarian Democracy is a great book, never read. How does one study totalitarianism and liberty and that type of thing without coming across him and so many others who have written about liberty? And yet today in the United States, we just tend to ignore this stuff, not teach it, and not to denigrate it, but we concentrate almost solely on being prepared to find your place in society. Get a job, in other words, and even that is as opposed to making your place in society.
And without treading on the political question, because I don't want to go there, but the every opportunity should be seized in events and current events and opportunity in the debate in the public square to come back to those first principles. And I agree with you completely. We often overlook it, and we see leaders who take it for granted that people share those values, when in fact what they have to do is educate and explain what those values are and why they're important.
Let's go to our next caller. We have one more question in the queue at this point. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Congressman McIntosh, Mike Ain in Nashville, Tennessee. You worked very closely with Vice President Quayle on much of the regulatory reforms that were done in the late 80s and early 90s. Is any of that useful to what we're trying to accomplish now? I know it was designed to do the sensible, smart thing, and now we're trying to prevent just the opposite. But can any of that be utilized in this effort?
Hi, Mike. It's great. That's a great question. The several things from there. One, the core principle that was used in that process was a cost-benefit justification for a lot of these regulations. And what we've seen since that time is there's been a growing acceptance that that's a useful tool in analyzing different regulatory options. But the progressives have really insisted that it be only a tool and not the deciding factor. So if there's other values, such as we must do something to end climate change, those will trump the cost-benefit factor. And so, again, you've got that's a policy decision that the Reagan and Bush administrations used as a screen in reviewing all of the work of the different agencies under them. This president's shifted away from that, and so Congress needs to step in and use its powers, again, of the purse and oversight to reassert that evaluation of the regulations, point out to the public where the costs are being incurred, and you know that the decision-making factor is something other than the benefit and cost of the economy. And then, frankly, Congress will need to pick up the burden that used to be done in the reg review of asking what's the impact on employment. And the president's very sensitive to that. The website I mentioned that we can't wait is under the economy and what are we doing to create jobs section. And so if you have a Congress that's willing to put that question before them and before the American public for each one of these rules and regulations, that's a way for them to engage in that debate and over the policy differences. Another thing that we saw when I was doing the review was that you would oftentimes have what the theorists refer to as public choice, or public choice economists refer to as, you know, the capture of the regulatory agencies by the regulated entities. And therefore, you'd see the private sector, who maybe stood to have a benefit in their competition with others if a certain regulation was passed, support the government exercise of power and come in and lobby in favor of some regulations where they could get an advantage over their competitor in the marketplace. When the scope of federal regulation becomes so pervasive, as we're seeing in Dodd-Frank and the financial services market, you have some of that. The potential for that's enormous, where the largest entities that are going to be not only very heavily regulated but also heavily subsidized in taking risks because they can't be allowed to fail. At some point, you could imagine one or more of those entities turning around and saying, okay, we have to live in this regime. Now we want this type of regulation, and their purpose would be to make sure no other entity can compete with them and rise to the level of market power that they have. That's only one of the dangers inherent in a structure like that, where you've got so much government control over a particular sector in the economy that you could ultimately have the regulators captured by the incumbents and therefore dramatically reduce the ability of competition and new entry into the marketplace. Those are all different economic principles that we understood when we were doing the regulations and would, you know, question people who came in to lobby, why are you in favor of this rule but against another one, and try to discern what was going on there. I think now, unfortunately, you've got a phenomena that's been labeled in the public debate as kind of crony capitalism, where some of the political actors have decided we'll make a partnership with the regulated sectors of the economy, give them benefits of lighter regulation or regulations that help them compete against others, or subsidies, and as you've seen in the energy sector, where you see tremendous subsidies for certain types of new energy, alternative energy. That sort of crony capitalism is a byproduct of the expansion of government, and it will be reinforced in the regulatory process as it has been in the appropriation and tax sides of what the government does to interfere with free markets. those are all lessons we learned in that review process that are enormously valuable today. Let me close on this part by saying one of the ideas that Senator Lee mentioned is a great antidote to that, and it's the RAINS Act that would require major regulations to be once again put through the process of approval by Congress, where you've got at least the Democratic check of a majority having to develop to support the regulation going forward, with some procedural checks for the minority in the Senate and the filibuster. And so I'm a big proponent of that RAINS Act as a way of reasserting some congressional check on a runaway or expansive executive branch.
Very good. Looks like we're out of questions. I'll come to you in a minute to see if you have any final thoughts, David McIntosh. In the interim, I want to remind our audience to go to the Federalist Society's new blog. It is live now. It went live during this call and can be visited at any point in time. It's executivebranchproject.com. It's executivebranchproject, all one word, .com. So I urge folks to go there, bookmark the page, visit it often, comment, join the debate. There's a lot of, I think, unique and neat features about the blog. You can sort blog entries by content, so if you're just interested in environmental law or health law or the Affordable Care Act implementation, you can click a button and sort the blog by those different features. It also has a blog RSS feed, so if you click on a tab called Blog Feed, you'll get a scrolling page that has the last three entries from all the various blogs around the Internet. So do check it out. Go there. Return, comment. Again, it's executivebranch.com, executivebranchproject.com. And with that, David McIntosh, let me give you a minute to see if you have any final thoughts or if you want to wrap up.
I just want to commend you, Dean, and the Federalist Society for undertaking this project. I think it's tremendously significant, not only in the questions about what's going on in the regulations and executive authority, but as we're seeing in the public comments that you referred to in the press, implications for the judicial branch and what type of appointments will be sent forward there, and will they be people that asked or expected to rubber stamp an assertion of presidential authority in these areas. All hugely important questions, great for the public debate, and I commend you for raising the subject.
Well, thank you so much. I want to, in his absence, thank Senator Lee for joining us today, and of course, thank David McIntosh for joining us. For our audience, again, the blog address is executivebranchproject.com. Please feel free to visit it at any point in time, and please do comment on the post you see there. I also want to invite our audience to join us for our next Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 12 noon, when we'll be talking about the possibility of an internet sales tax. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.